Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and I've got Matthew Lucas with me. Hey, Matthew.
Hello.
Good to see you. So we just finished recording a podcast interview all about Matthew's film, Kringle Time, which you can watch right now. You should go buy it on iTunes or Apple Movie, whatever it is, various services, or you can go to Prime Video on a nice big TV and watch it. Never watch a movie on a phone, by the way. But
Or don't tell us that you did.
Yeah, that's right. But Kringle Time with a K. Kringle Time is a hilarious dark comedy. You should absolutely watch it. It won awards at Filmvasion Los Angeles in 2021. Right before the world opened up, we had a virtual festival, but an in-person. And I got to meet Matthew, and I said, hey, you should do the podcast sometime.
And here we are.
And here we are. And this podcast is Matthew answering the four questions, which are favorite films of all time, an underrated film, an overrated film, and a lesser-known film that people should seek out. Just kind of a fun thing. I saw these questions as what would come at the end of every podcast, but then the podcasts are over an hour most of the time. And asking people to listen to another 20 minutes of favorites. And then, truth be told, there's a lot of people who just go listen to all the four questions ones because, you know, it's movie references. So you want to dive in? You want to share some of your favorites?
Yeah, let's go for it. So let me start off by saying this question is bullshit. It always has been. It's
complete
the hardest
bullshit
question to answer.
It's annoying, but it's not best films of all time. It's just
that's
favorites.
This is where I ultimately, because I thought about this for a while, and every time someone asks me this, especially like meeting people that don't work in this line of work, when they find out that you work in film or have made a movie, they're like, what's the best movie? What's your favorite movie? And it's implied I can't answer it. I don't know. Because I want to answer like, what's the movie that impressed me most? I think as a work of art, it's the most complete work of art, whatever. I want to go there. But then I'm like, but honestly, like Jurassic Park is probably my favorite movie. And it's the movie I have probably watched the most over and over and over and over again. And when you sit down and think, okay, I'm a 35-year-old man, and my favorite movie is this Dinosaurs Get Loose in the Park thriller.
It's an amazing achievement.
It's a very good movie. Yeah, yes. And it's got a lot of really cool things about it. But I mean, it almost feels embarrassing.
We lived, I'm older, but we lived a long time and never saw a realistic dinosaur.
Yeah.
And then finally we get a realistic dinosaur. And
it did so many good. I think that the Harryhausen approach was used pretty early in pre-production for Jurassic Park. And when they finally sort of pivoted, realizing that they demoed the CGI tech and it could actually work as well as it did. It still holds up too. I think people use
but
this
they had
as
animatronic
an example
too.
Yeah.
Right?
They mixed them. Yeah. And they did it so well. Still to this day. If you really are looking at it with scrutiny, I think it still works. It's right there on the line between, a movie like that getting made now, like the new, I don't even watch the new Jurassic World movies or whatever, but I watched the first one and they can do unlimited effects shots. So they do. There's no the limit of how much you could get away with and it still be believable meant that in the early 90s and certainly before that, and Spielberg, of course, pioneered this with Jaws, not showing the creature is often so much better than seeing it. And so, I know the T-Rex has a lot of screen time in Jurassic Park because they can, but it's not as much as it would be if that movie were made today. It would just be all focus really on all that stuff.
I think you're 100% right. And I might even argue that because they can't wow us with effects back then, they had to devote a little more time to story.
Yeah.
Because you had to actually get involved in those people's lives to care if the dinosaurs are eating them.
Yeah, mattered a lot more. Yeah.
But now I haven't seen the newer ones because it's just not on my radar.
Yeah.
But I'm sure it is gorgeous to look at, and the story's a little weaker because it can be.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately.
Unfortunately. All right, so Jurassic Park,
I would say I would almost put in a dead heat tie with Big Lebowski because I think beyond the the nostalgic itch that I'm scratching by answering Jurassic Park, this Big Lebowski probably has it to a degree, but I actually think that on paper, I still read the Big Lebowski script sometimes for fun just because it's just that it manages to straddle a line I'm really interested in, which is incredibly stupid and like base comedy, right? And heightened language in a way. Like, I mean, like they get away with such a weird spectrum of language in that movie. You know, ever thus to deadbeats Lebowski. They say, like, why is that line in this movie? And in the first, like, 5 minutes. It's like, it's kind of an anomaly, a movie like that. And I think the Coens obviously do that so well in most of their work, straddling the tonal line between something being, like, people being stupid and absurd, doing stupid things, and then dealing with it in a sort of, like, very clever,
intelligent way. It's an intelligent film with some dumb characters.
Yeah.
But... yeah, even, you know, Walter's a fucking idiot. There's no way around it.
Right.
He just is. And yet you love him. And the story, yeah. I mean, yeah, they're
amazing. He's a goddamn war hero, so.
I did not die in the mud. My friends died in the mud. But besides that, it's just, it's incredible filmmaking. And one thing I always love saying when people bring up the Coen brothers is I've read, you know, I'm a nerd and I'm a big fan of theirs. And they've always considered themselves comedy writers.
Yeah.
Like, from the beginning. Even, you know, Blood Simple obviously wasn't comedy. But yeah, Raising Arizona On, like, even when they're doing something serious, they're comedy writers.
Yeah.
And they're amazing.
Some of their most dead serious movies are, like, True Grit is a laugh-out-loud movie. Which is silly to think about.
Yeah. But Lebowski is... Lebowski's it's perfection.
Great. Classic.
Yeah. It's perfection. Yeah. It's a... And the fucking balls to the fucking courage. I'm trying to get a gender neutral in my praise.
Right.
of the stoned fantasy sequences, the knockout
really
sequences,
good. And probably in a way, movies like that, fed into in Kringle Time in my feature. Like, you know, there are a number of like interspersed haunting sequences that sort of leave the reality of the movie and go there. So I mean, like, as much as it's a movie, I just love watching because it's funny and it scratches that itch for me. It probably also influenced my work.
Yeah.
And I mean, all those classics.
Yeah, I mean, it's hilarious and it's great cinema and it's great filmmaking. And Maude Lebowski has forever changed the way I pronounce the word vagina. I mean, how funny is that? Yeah, like, she may not have a funny bone in her body away from their scripts, but when she's doing a Coen Brothers, she's... hilarious.
Well, I mean, in a way, that's the funniest part of movies like that is playing it straight. You know, like the characters in those movies don't know they're in a comedy, right? They're like,
yeah,
Walter is the most laugh-out-loud.
They don't cast comedians.
Thing. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, no, it's great. Those kinds of movies really, really get me. And like the ending too of that movie, just kind of sending it out on an aloof note that, like, you know, things will go on. Not really sure if anything changed here, but here we go. And then it ends on that, the strike, you know, or what we assume is the strike being rolled.
That's such a good
ending. Yeah.
Strikes and gutters.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So clearly it should be on everyone's face. If you quote the film.
Oh, great. Yeah.
I guess that would be a more fair question. It would be less pressure. What film do you quote the most?
Yeah. So those are easier ones. I mean, like, and we haven't even talked about, like, you know, good, actually good classic movies that I would consider perfect. And
Want to throw in a third favorite?
Well, no, if I threw in a third favorite, I wouldn't even go that road. Cause I think that there's a scholarly answer to that question. And then there's the truer answer, which is like, you know, what can you watch on repeat? What's your go-to? Both of those definitely are there. I would say, I would just add my third and final pick might be Scott Pilgrim versus the World. It's a movie that and probably all these movies just come along at the right time for your, you know, developmental phase or whatever. I remember, well, I still use Scott Pilgrim as an example of, like, that's a movie I wish I had made. You know, there's a lot of movies I watch that I just enjoy, but I never really think, like, oh, I could make a Big Lebowski. I could make Jaws, you know, whatever. I don't think I could, you know, it just wouldn't be my... If I was sitting down with a blank slate, I don't think I would write or make either of those movies. But like, but Scott Pilgrim's one where I'm kind of like, oh man, I just wish I'd had that idea first and made that movie first.
It's an amazing film. I came to it late. I missed it because I was too old for it.
Right.
But it is genius. It's pure genius.
It really is. Yeah. I think it has like maybe exactly one sort of misstep tonally. Early on, the Matthew Patel fight, which I believe is the first of the exes that he fights, I think it's just a little bit too weird for the rest of the movie. I'm not sure. I feel like, especially in movies that kind of are out there, you know, with their concept like that one is, you have a responsibility pretty early to, like, this is the movie you're in for. You basically have to say that in so many actions, right? Like, these are the rules of this universe. You know, this is, Scott is going to have these crazy dream sequences. He's going to beat somebody up and pick up coins, just like in the video games, hardy, hardy, har. I think you have to, you owe that to the audience very early in those high concept movies to be like, here's the playground we're in. So expect to this. And I don't know that by the time the Matthew Patel fight scene happens that we've been given permission to go that far with it. Like, it's pretty crazy, especially compared to some of the fight scenes that follow, which are slightly more palatable in their references. You know, that one's like, people are flying around, you know, Matthew Patel, the design of that character is so weird. Like, he's just kind of, it's just like a hair out there. He does, I think Edgar Wright does one thing to try to mitigate that, and that's that he cuts away to Anna Kendrick's character, and she has this look on her face where she's like, what the fuck am I looking at here?
Yeah, because there was no martial arts up until that point, right?
Yeah. Which is like, you know, it's hard to criticize it too, because, like, you know, a movie like From Dusk Till Dawn goes like half the runtime before it's like, oh, okay, it's a different movie now. So, like,
well, that's the ultimate example of a shift in tone. You're making me realize that a thing about Scott Pilgrim is, it's better every time you watch it.
For sure. Yeah.
And that's probably why, because the better you know it, the more you just love it. Which is, you know, how many films, and Big Lebowski, it's such a unique universe. Every time you watch it, you kind of enjoy it more. I mean, even though you watch it a hundred times. Yeah, those films you can watch over and over and enjoy more every time. That's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
Because it's hard to read your favorite book all over again.
No, I know people that do that, and they're like, I've read this book 6 times. I'm like, that's a lot of time.
My record's 3 for a book. But yeah. All right. Question number 2.
Yeah.
A film that is underrated.
An underrated movie to me is a movie called Joe Versus the Volcano. Do you know it?
That's the Tom Hanks movie I didn't see when it was in theaters.
Yeah. And, so this is a weird one because I feel like it's fairly assessed as a whole piece, meaning like on the whole, assessing the movie poorly, which is fair. It is fair. It is fair to assess the movie and be like, you know what? Yeah, it's not that great as a whole. But when I think about that movie, I remember the first time I watched it, the setup, the first act, almost all of the second act, really, really good. It falls apart entirely in the third, which is like the case with almost every movie. You know, it's like 90% of movies cannot come across the home plate. But in this movie, I just think it's such a unique world. It's so funny and quirky, and it has a pretty decent message. You know, it's by John Patrick Shanley, the guy that did Doubt, and like is maybe known more for more surreal playwright, and he's like a more cerebral sort of creator.
Didn't he also do like Five Corners, I think? But yeah, he was just getting. Yeah, Joe Versus the Volcano was early in his.
Yeah, yes, you're right, and it's you know, of course it's Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan. And it's like, I think they marketed it as like a romantic comedy because that was like their golden era or whatever, and like it has elements of that. But I don't know. It's like it's so much more fun than I think the pitch for it is, and I think it has something to say without being too self-serious, which is another one of my favorite just things about. Movie. I mean, you know, Big Lebowski is another good example of that too. It's like movies that don't take themselves too seriously and have something really interesting to say. Burn After Reading is another great Coen Brother example. It's like by the end you're just like, you know, you realize that you've sat through a critique of like American life, as it were, and like our obsession with little conspiracies and being in on the action and our vanity and all this stuff and just being dumb. And they've done it in the least serious way possible. It's just the most aloof look at these things. And I don't think that Joe vs. the Volcano is quite on the same level, but it has a similar vein of like, oh, okay, I'm not just like shutting my brain off and watching people fall in love here. This is like a legitimate kind of interesting comment on the capitalism sort of like a loop that he finds himself in, or like hypochondriac nature and self-diagnosing and thinking that things are so much more important and fatal than they are. and like a, yeah, a literally fatal commitment to a stupid goal that is like someone else's who's richer than you. I mean, those are all ideas that are explored in this movie, but it's the most like silly slapstick.
Yeah, no, I mean, way to approach what it. I know of the story. Yeah, I mean, the analogy is a pretty big punch in the face for
right,
but the killing yourself for money.
The big problem is that because it doesn't stick the landing, you don't walk away from the movie thinking like, oh, wow, what an interesting, complex critique. You're more like, well, that was fucking weird. What happened there at the end with Abe Pagoda?
Especially the days of when we would see movies in the theater, it was always about the ending, right? Like a film with a great ending, if it was and then a great ending, you walked out happy.
Yeah.
And if it was great with an ending, you walked out like, I don't like that.
That's important. I mean, yeah, you want to leave with a good... I mean, it's so hard, though, to stick the landing. It's really hard. It's easy to have a good idea, like, to set up, like, oh, here would be a cool idea for a movie. How many times have you said that? I mean, it's a thing. But then it's impossible once you start writing. You're like, well, okay, but how does everybody die at the end? I don't know what to do.
I can name incredibly successful people who I don't think have ever written a decent ending. Right. I don't know why they don't just start with the ending.
Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah. And shit, especially American TV. All right, so... Question number three is a film that's overrated, which we did a little preamble on before we started recording. But, you know, it's not a knock. You're not saying it's a bad film. You're just saying the acclaim it receives may be overblown.
For sure. Well, let me say that, one, I believe we live in a time when almost everything is overrated. You know, I feel like everything...
This whole simulation is overrated.
Exactly. it's an issue that... has extended not just in like professional critique of film, but also in casual conversation. I feel like almost everything that people talk about, you know, that's popular now. It's really tough to get behind it from a, like the discussion around the quality of the filmmaking is never quite there when you're talking about, let's just pick on Marvel because it's the biggest one, but there's other offenders. If you're making projects, I think at that level, you know, the quality of the filmmaking is not being assessed. It's really not. It is a distant secondary concern to like what is the cultural impact, and that's a kind way of putting it. What's the cultural impact of these characters and of this movie? But the problem is that the cultural impact is like manufactured, and it's like it's a corporate agenda in a way. I sound like a libertarian, but like.
Which doesn't have to be a bad word. It's just sort of, there's just some libertarians who aren't libertarians.
Right. But, you know, it's like, it's tough to engage, I think, in discourse around things that are on everybody's lips because the discussion around the actual quality of the craft is not always there. And when it is, it's kind of superficial. Anyway, I didn't want to pick on one of those easy target movies. So the movie I picked was, Knives Out. And I say that, let me qualify it a little bit. I say this as a huge fan of the genre. I'm like a mass, I love, and maybe this is why I feel this way, but like Clue, for example, one of my all-time favorite movies. Loved watching it when I was young. I love the idea, maybe because it's slightly theatrical, that you put a group of interesting characters in a room, there's one problem, and everyone thinks about the problem differently. And then we have to, as the audience, we're like a participant in a way in like, what's the information that the screenwriter's feeding me? Am I supposed to know this? Am I trying to be smarter than this character? Ooh, I am smarter than that character. Look, they don't know what just happened. There's a lot of really cool stuff going on in that genre. Not to mention, it's an easy one to get away with that's hilarious. Like, I feel like doing comedy in that setting is really interesting and it's always fun. And you can always have different characters like come from different backgrounds sort of intersecting and making interesting things happen. But that movie, I feel like, I don't know that it totally knows what its own tone is a little bit, honestly. And that's, I know I'm the guy who made Kringle Time, which is a tonal tornado.
I think it's pretty consistent. I'm just going to chime in that I agree with you. And my review of Knives Out was very brief after I saw it. I think I turned to the people I was with and I said, did I just watch a whodunit who only had one possibility for the killer? Like, I needed at least one other person who could have done it.
Like, I think they did some interesting things like revealing his exact cause of death early. You know, that was, I remember the first time I watched it, like, okay, that's new. And then almost nothing kind of new happened.
All I remember is some good performances, in a bad story.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't even call it bad. I mean, the thing is, I've watched it. I don't really like the movie. I've watched it three times.
Oh, okay. I only saw it the one time.
Yeah, I saw it the first time, and then I was like, all right, I don't know. And then I gave it another chance, and I confirmed the fact that I didn't like it. And then I watched it on a plane with my wife because she wanted to watch it. So the third one is, I don't know that it counts. But, yeah, I don't know. And I hate, I don't like shitting on it too much because it does at least represent a newer concept inside of a studio system that I think broad by and large has become comfortable with, like, this is what we do and nobody ask any questions. So I mean, obviously it's the biggest star-studded cast you can imagine to assemble for something like that.
Yeah. And a fantastic cast.
But really, yeah, the cast really was great. And you know, and I like Rian Johnson enough. The movie was fine. But I think people, that's the one that has bugged me when people talk about, oh, I've seen Knives Out, it's like the greatest. And I'm like, yeah, it's good. It's fine. It's not the greatest. It's fine.
Yeah, I'm forgetting the name of it, but there was a sort of a whodunit with Hugo Weaving's daughter. That's how ignorant I am nowadays, how little I can remember. Oh, well, I won't look it up. But I thought there was... I love a whodunit. I love a murder mystery. But I admit, like, I need to not know. But anyway.
They're tough. It's a tough one, too, because it's a genre that's been done to death. So, like, to try to make something inside of there that feels fresh, you know, that's gonna be tough. So I mean,
I know I've got friends who are excited about Death on the Nile, which when we are recording this is, I think, about to hit theaters.
Yeah
might have hit theaters Friday, I don't know, but and I just can't get up for it.
Yeah, I watched the first of Branagh's attempts at that, and it was fine. Yeah, again, it's fine.
Well, in our previous podcast, we talked about people who act and direct at the same time, and that is definitely a gentleman who does not control his ego.
Yeah, he likes being in his pictures, and he has done that well for sure in the past. Much Ado About Nothing comes to mind. I loved this movie. I think that this questionable casting decisions in that movie, but I think he was fantastic and hilarious in that movie.
In Much Ado, yeah.
And I thought the movie itself was a bold type of a Shakespeare adaptation. A lot of fun.
Yeah. I'm just petty, too. Emma got me in the divorce, so. Oh. You know, what can I say?
Yeah.
I'll just come right out as such an Emma fanboy that.
That's fair.
That the guy who. That's fair. I believe he cheated on her. I won't gossip. So anyway, we have a fourth question, which is a lesser known film to seek out.
This was a really fun one to think about ahead of time. So I studied abroad in the Czech Republic for a time when I was in grad school, and got exposed to a lot of the Czech New Wave films that were coming through. Being able to study film somewhere other than the States gives you obviously already like a bit of a different perspective on what you do. And then the scholarly side of it is really like, unless you really seek out, like I'm taking a weekend and I'm going to do a deep dive into the Czech New Wave. Unless that's your goal, you're not really like walking in that film community, I think, unless you're living there. So I totally credit my physically being in that space with kind of learning some new and of some new and interesting filmmakers. One of them, a man by the name of Jan Švankmajer. He was an animator, filmmaker, made a lot of almost like claymation, stop motion animation films. And one in particular is called Jidlo, which means food in Czech.
And how's it spelled?
Jidlo.
All right.
There's an accent on one of those. But yeah, Jidlo, Jidlo.
But that's how it can be found on IMDb and such.
Yeah. Jidlo. Yeah. Well, it might be, I mean, I don't know. In an English listing, it might literally be called Food.
Oh, right. Yeah,
but the original title is Jidlo. Jan Švankmajer, it's a stop motion film. It's like, it has live actors in it, and then they contort a little bit as they consume different pieces of food. They might pick up they pick up a shoe and they cut it into a couple pieces and put the shoe in their mouth, and their mouth like kind of grows to expand and consume this whole thing. And it's a pretty easy to spot metaphor for, you know, consumption and our relationship to not only food, which is a big part of it, but also our consumption of other earthly things, including each other. So it gets pretty, it's a little weird. And I mean, if you, and there are weirder Jan Švankmajer films than Yidlov, but it gets pretty surreal. And I really like those movies are fun, I think, to look at, not only because they're like the, having the freedom to be in the surreal space gives you the option of being like kind of on the nose with your metaphor, but doing it in a way that's maybe more fun than you might get away with in a narrative feature where you have like an obligation to reality a little bit more. So having like an animation, it's like a 15-minute short. So like having that format, I think really like kind of frees you up to just be like, yeah, here's one idea in a weird way to illustrate it. And it's a really, really good example of that. And I think they can be inspiring. Like, I don't know that I've ever really thought of anything actively in Yidlow in my work, but like, I remember making Kringle Time, looking at some of the early experimental work of, Jim Henson, which is weirder than the Muppets. Let's put it that way. It's pretty trippy. And, he does some really cool, like, match cut stuff from like someone falling off like a cliff or whatever, and then it cutting to the an olive dropping in a martini like on action, and like he'll keep that going, those little transitions that match with action between different subjects, and some of them are pretty goofy, and they feel like experimental movies. They all feel kind of like not something you're sitting down with your friends you're just having a rip-roaring popcorn good time. But I don't know. There's it frees up your brain just a little bit more to just be like, oh, that's weird, and makes me think of something hyper specific in a different context.
That's very cool. It's very cool. You got to be in another country and get into their culture and their cinema, because Lord knows we don't get enough from overseas.
Yeah.
It's hard to pursue.
In a popular way. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, we see a couple things from England, couple things from Australia, and maybe one or two from the continent.
Yeah.
And like that's it.
Right. Yeah, in broad release, yeah.
Yeah. And now we're getting Korean. We're getting stuff from the Korean Peninsula, but that's about it. Yeah, so that's
cool. It was definitely a really good experience, and it's the first time and only time I've directed something in a different language. That was a really interesting challenge.
Did you learn Czech well enough to...
No, I mean, I learned Czech enough to, you know, yell cut and stuff like that. But
But their English was good enough for you to...
Well, one, I wrote the script in English and then had to have a translator. Translates a comedy, and like comedy is one of those things that don't, you know, they don't translate... Comedy doesn't translate too well between languages, because there's so many, like, for example, in Czech, in the Czech sort of zeitgeist, I guess... A puppetry is a huge thing, you know, like marionette theater is like a big historical thing in the Czech Republic, and so it's like kind of in the back of everybody's mind to a degree, in a way that's like obviously not a cultural thing here. And I remember there's like a dick joke in this movie, and I never would have thought to write it this way. The Czech literal translation from the Czech version of that joke is something like, well, even with a small puppet you can make great theater. And that's just a joke that I suppose in English works without any additional context, but the word puppet and theater, it's not drawing something for you and I. It's not like instantly be like, oh, like marionette theater. We're not thinking on that level, but they are. So it's like much more funny to them. And that joke simply, like when we put the subtitle on screen, it's not translated the same way. So like,
right. So the person who translated for you actually did a cultural translation as well, and made it work for.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's, so it's not literal. I mean, it was a really fascinating. Yeah, and then like thinking of it in both of those ways on set, also very interesting. And I remember like the lead actor. I remember when we first started, the older guy, when we worked together, he's like, "So do you want this in the American style?" And I was like, "I don't know what that is. What does that mean? What is the American style?" He's like, "Well, you know, like Jim Carrey or something like really crazy over the top." And I was like, "Is that?" So then I learned like, so this is the like default image of even an actor, even someone like who's a professional, not just like a culture, not you're just walking something on the street, what's your idea of American cinema? It's a guy who works in movies, you know, his idea of American cinema is Jerry Lewis, or is like someone like over the top, you know,
slapstick.
Yeah. And I found that really interesting, and then I had to rein him in, because I don't think I really did want you know, I like, you know, like pratfalls as much as the next guy, but I wouldn't say it was like the touchstone of what we were trying to accomplish. And so I had to, he got in his brain, I'm making an as an American guy who wants me to be like an American funny man. And it was a tough one to try to break down that barrier. I don't know that we really did.
For sure. I mean, talk about a challenging situation, being in another country and dealing with your own understanding of their culture and then their understanding of yours.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was very interesting. Yeah. He brought baggage with him that he couldn't set down.
And we all do. And I mean, it's not, and there's so many situations like that. People come with a preconceived notion of what this should be. And then in the moment, it's not working. You don't know why, because you read it 100,000 times and you have to figure it out. So it's a similar issue, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean to try to sound like a know-it-all, but I happened, from my time there, I was there for a week, but I learned that it's Czechia.
Yes, now it is. And that's
and
recent,
us
though.
Calling it Czech Republic is like some dumb, like, why can't we just call it Czechia? They call it Czechia.
I should have called it Czechia.
Because in this country, if you say Czechia, no one knows what you're talking about.
But it is a new thing. Like, it was Czech Republic when I was there, and that was in 2013. And they only renamed it like 3-4 years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's a relatively new.
No, because I was told that when I was there with the ex-wife. I don't know.
Well, maybe they internally referred it to it that way. It wasn't officially changed, but like now on a map, like on Google Maps, if you go there, it's Czechia now. Yeah.
Yeah, which is interesting. I don't know. I traveled a lot, and like when I was in Turkey, I had this guide my age, like one-on-one at, you know, Roman ruins, and he was like, you know, we know you call us Turkey. This is Turkia. It's, they even spell it, and when they, you, because they use our alphabet, they spell it Turkiye, Turkiye. And I'm like, why do we call it Turkey? And I guess it's because the British are pricks.
Yeah.
Like, I've always had this, like, renamed it.
I guess I get that, and this is with people's first names too, when you're in another culture, it's like, I get that. If you don't have those syllables in your regular use, or like, you know, whatever, it's going to be a little, you have to work a little harder to get somebody's name pronounced correctly or get someone's country. But like, there are some that I don't get. Like, Spain is España. Could we not just call it España? Is that difficult to pronounce?
But we don't call Romania Romani, and Bulgaria didn't become Bulgari. So, so why couldn't Turkey stay Turkey?
Exactly. That's not that difficult to pronounce.
Yeah. I don't know. It's the British, man. The British showed up in Rome and said, oh, that's Tevere. We're going to call it Tiber.
Right. Yeah.
Couldn't they have just spelled everything phonetically? I don't know.
Silly.
It's really the British problem. They thought they controlled the world. And I think it was actually, just like, you know. When a racist asshole intentionally pronounces things wrong on purpose.
Don't know who you're talking about.
I think it was the British culture of like, yes, we must make sure everyone knows we're superior. We can change your name.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know. All right. Play. Okay. That was a tangent.
Geopolitics. Here we go.
All right. We got, good one. And it is actually called Food on IMDb. I wanted to make sure.
Yeah. Check it out. It's a 15-minute and easy watch.
And if you want to make sure you find it, if you want to know how to spell the director's name, you have to spell it Svankmajer. And you pronounced it well. I'm not going to try to say Schwankmeyer.
Well, and check the S that has a little carrot on top. That's a sh sound, so it's Schwankmeyer. Yeah.
Exactly. They add dots in weird places. I don't like it. I'll stop pretending that I'm an ugly American and
make Czechia great again. I think that's the lesson here.
Make Czechia. We should. Oh, such a beautiful country.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah,
it is amazing. Yeah. All right. So you just heard Matt Lucas answer those four questions, and then we rambled on about country names and stuff for a little while. But his film Kringle Time is something you should watch on Amazon Prime Video or other VOD sources. And you want to name your website and such?
Oh, yeah. The website is matthewlucas.co, not com. Don't even try com. You're not going to like what you find there. And my Instagram is...
Is there another Matthew Lucas who's like a really bad seed?
Well, do you know, there's the British actor, Matt Lucas, who's the...
Yeah,
he's in a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, he's very cool, the alopecia guy.
Yeah. Yes, yeah.
Or he's hairless.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
He's funny.
Yeah, he's very funny. Yeah. Just a terrible name. So terrible
you, name. You share a name with him.
Yeah. So that's why professionally I go by Matthew. But yeah.
Got it. No, I mean, look, Jeff Howard is a little on the common side. I don't know if you noticed.
I'm on a lot of no-fly lists.
I haven't left home for so long. But yeah, actually, of all the crazy... anyway, not about me. All right, so MatthewLucas.co.
Yeah.
And MattLucas.mov.
That's
is your at MattLucas.mov is Instagram if people want to check it out. Cool. I'm going to now name all the things. By the way, before I ask you to follow and subscribe this podcast, I just did. But give the podcast 5 stars if you see anywhere. And Matt's film, Kringle Time. If you watch Kringle Time, you should. It's on Amazon Prime Video, so you can watch it for free. Doesn't cost you anything. You should watch it. And then you should give it a 5-star review because it's good. It's indie dark comedy. We don't get enough of that. You know, what can I say?
Doesn't sell. That's why
it's tough. Dark comedy probably is tough to sell, it's very hard, which is too bad.
It's literally the worst genre if you're trying to make money. I think horror, indie, yes, do that.
Yeah, it's true. And horror is good. Horror comedy. I like the horror comedy that goes together. For but sure. It's. I know, man. I feel your pain. Look, the Discovery Indie Film TV series that was born out of this podcast. It's all really good drama and art house, a little bit of comedy. And of course, everyone I've presented it to says, how much horror is in it? And I'm like, not a lot.
I'm surprised. I feel like
all the people with horror shorts have bigger dreams of getting it on other platforms. And I'm like, well, if you feel like it, you can, you know, it's only if it's a horror director who considers himself kind of cinema-y.
Right.
Like, then they are like game.
Yeah.
But, you know, what are you going to do? Everyone wants... Whatever, horror is horror. And horror is fun. I've learned to appreciate horror more in my middle age from raising a kid who became addicted to horror at age 13.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was my whole lockdown, was watching 2 horror films every Friday and Saturday night. So 4 films a week.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah. I filled in a lot of gaps.
I'm sure.
Believe it, yeah. Gotta love a shark movie. Anyway... I'm supposed to ramble off a bunch of things. So yeah, give Matt's film, Kringle Time, 5 stars on Amazon.com and watch the film on Amazon Prime. And then give this podcast 5 stars and give the Discovery Indie Film TV series on Amazon Prime Video 5 stars and give yourself 5 stars. And if you want to learn more about all this madness, just the website for the podcast and TV series is discoveryindiefilm.com. And on social media, it's at DIFWINS. And I learned about Kringle Time. I think I mentioned it won awards at Film Invasion Los Angeles in June of 2021. If you want to learn about that festival, go to filminvasionla.com. Social media, it's at filminvasionla. And that's every June. And its sister festival that happens every November is the Sherman Oaks Film Festival. ShermanOaksFF.com and at ShermanOaksFF on social media. And I think I've said my piece. I forgot to mention another thing in the last one, so I'll leave it out of this one too. But I'm going to mention it to Matt as soon as we stop recording.
The suspense. So, oh, man.
Yeah. Yeah, live with that one. You'll have to contact him through his Instagram and ask him what I talked about, because I won't tell. All right. So thank you, Matt, for coming in.
Thank you, Jeff.
And thank you, everyone, for listening.